everyone. There's only so much time in the day. That's why we edited this Vermont Edition podcast for brevity. I know you'll thank us.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Close to 50,000 people fell ill in Vermont's last pandemic. The 1918 influenza, often called the Spanish flu, tore through the state in late summer and fall of that year more than a century ago. Deaths in Vermont from that flu outbreak are estimated at more than 2,000. This hour, we're going to talk with historians about that pandemic, the artifacts and records we have to remember it, and how we're preserving records today for our present-day pandemic. Let's hear from some Vermonters who lived through the 1918 flu. Susan Sleeper of St. Johnsbury was a teacher when the flu struck.
I was teaching school that fall, and schools were closed for a time. Somebody came to my door, his school, said to send the children home. School was closed down for the influenza.
Ernest Reynolds was a young boy in Barrie in 1918. He grew up to become a physician, but he recalls a grim daily reminder of the pandemic just outside his bedroom.
Looking out of my bedroom window, you could see Beckley Hill very clearly. The Catholic cemetery was only about a quarter of a mile up this hill. And day after day during that epidemic, you see this funeral procedure, all horses, black horses and black hearses and so forth going by there, and sometimes three or four funerals a day. Being sick in bed and doing nothing else but looking out the window there, you got quite an impression when you saw all these people. That was the end of the road when I was going up in that black hearse there.
And Georgina Bottomini, also in Barrie, remembered how the so-called flu took her father.
My dad was a very strong individual, and he died at the age of 28. And I can always remember Dr. McFarland saying that if they had had things like sulfa, he would have survived. My mother was pregnant and so ill with the flu that she could not go to the funeral, and she recalled hearing the hearse go by the house as he was being taken to the cemetery.
Those voices of Vermonters remembering the 1918 flu pandemic were captured by Woodsmoke Productions and the Vermont Historical Society for a broadcast of the Green Mountain Chronicles in 1988 and 1989. Let's dive into the history that brought this deadly strain of influenza to Vermont and how state leaders and the public responded at the time. Historian and writer Mark Bushnell joins us now. Mark wrote about this history in a piece for VT Digger in early March. Mark, it's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Oh, happy to be here, Jane.
So can you talk a little bit about how and when what was called the Spanish flu came to Vermont and, you know, what Vermonters already knew about this pandemic?
Sure. First of all, the calling it the Spanish flu is a bit of a misnomer, though it's the name that's always associated with it. Researchers actually believe it probably started in Kansas. The first major outbreak was at an Army base in Kansas in March of 1918. This is the middle of World War I, and those troops shipped over to Europe, and it spread around Europe, and Spain was a neutral country, so it was the only one whose newspapers weren't being censored, and so they told about how it was devastating Europe, and of course, Vermonters were reading those papers and must have put two and two together and realized it could reach our shores, return to our shores. And it did. And one of the major hotspots was Fort Devens, Massachusetts, where a lot of Vermonters actually were stationed. And the belief is that Vermonters were going down to visit sick loved ones who were at the camp. And that's actually the most likely way that a lot of the disease came back to Vermont. It might be helpful to look at a timeline of the disease to get a sense of how quickly this hit Vermont and how devastating it was.
Yeah.
The response came almost entirely from state and local officials then. The federal government was basically silent. It wasn't as big a government. It didn't have the resources it would have now. On September 21st, 1918, the state Board of Health told local health officers that that they needed to report any influenza cases because they wanted to keep tabs on this. And they told them they had the right to placard the houses of people who had flu. So they wanted to send warnings to people. Only 3 days later, Vermont papers were saying, look out, the flu could come in the coming days or weeks. But in fact, it was already here because elsewhere in those same papers, there were reports that dozens of students at Middlebury College and Norwich University were sick. 3 days after that, the state got in touch with those local health officers who were really important in making a lot of the decisions on the ground and told them that they had the right to close places of public assembly. They were just like churches and schools. They were just trying to prevent large public gatherings. So they understood that that's how the disease could spread. But the state also said it would probably not take that step. And just days later, Vermonters started dying in waves. Between September 28th and October 2nd, those 4 days, 40 people died of the flu in Barrie alone. A couple of the quotes from those people we heard earlier were Barrie residents, and Barrie was particularly hard hit. I think 10% of the fatalities in the state almost were in Barrie, and it's probably because that's where the granite industry is, and a lot of the people had weakened lungs from breathing in granite dust.
Hmm. You know, you bring up so many points that I want to tease out here because it's so interesting. I mean, for one thing, we think now about what's happening with COVID-19 and the global spread that is accelerated by so many people traveling all around the world so quickly on airplanes. And of course, you know, there wasn't air travel like that in 1918. However, as you mentioned, there were soldiers going from the U.S. to Europe or coming back. And even within the United States, despite the fact that we don't think of people traveling in quite the same way we do now, this spread very quickly from place to place to place and all over the world.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and if it hadn't been for World War I, I'm sure the death toll would have been a lot less. I mean, estimates now are that somewhere between, usually the estimates say between 20 million and 50 million people worldwide were killed in this epidemic. Some put the estimates as high as 100 million. You know, those things are very hard to track even now. And trying to look back 100 years, it's almost impossible.
Wow. I mean, you also talk about Middlebury students and Norwich students being sick with the flu. And with COVID-19, we worry in particular for people with compromised immune systems, but also people in their older years. For the flu, the pandemic in 1918, you know, as we're referring to it, the Spanish flu, it struck younger people pretty hard, too. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The worst age to be at the time was in your prime of life, in your 20s or 30s, because it seemed like people's immune systems sort of went into overdrive. People could die within 24 hours of the onset of symptoms. It was just really horrifying.
Yeah.
What people must have gone through. And the death rate was put at something like 2.5% of people who showed symptoms.
Wow. And so that meant as well that there were a lot of orphans who were victims of the pandemic because their parents in their 20s and 30s and 40s were dying.
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest tragedies of this, that so many of those young, healthy people, like the woman on the tape you just played,
yeah,
you know, who lost her father at 28.
Yeah. And her mother was pregnant and so sick that she couldn't even attend the funeral either. I mean, what a tragedy for so many families.
Well, yeah, actually, they banned people who were sick or had been with the ill from attending funerals. That was one of the first quarantines put in.
Hmm.
But back to the timeline, I mean, communities were making individual decisions. For example, Stowe, Rutland, and Shelburne banned all public meetings. They closed, you know, schools and church services, closed like pool halls and things like that. Middlebury quarantined its entire campus. The state Supreme Court postponed the start of its session. Companies weren't required to close at the time, but some of them had half their workforce sick. There were rural telephone exchanges that went silent because the operators were sick. So it sort of was a de facto closure at times. Something I wanted to mention was that, like, I mean, now we talk a lot about, concerned about the economic impact of this, and there was some talk of that. But in those days, the biggest concern that politicians mentioned was hurting the war effort, because some of the money raised for the war was coming through Liberty Bonds. People would buy bonds to support the war. Vermont Governor Horace Graham actually wrote a letter saying, you know, I'm a little worried about closing down things because we won't be able to raise money for the war. Philadelphia went ahead and had this massive parade in the middle of the outbreak. Something like 200,000 people turned out for this Liberty Bond parade. And within a week, they had 2,600 people had died from the flu a week later.
So some of the lessons that we're learning about quarantining and social isolation and the measures that are being put in place around the world today were learned from 1918.
Yeah, well, they already knew it. I mean, quarantines, the idea that the understanding that you needed to separate yourself from the sick dates back to the Middle Ages. I mean, people have known that for a while, even before they really understood germ theory.
Hmm. We're talking with Mark Bushnell, historian and author, and we're looking at how Vermont fared in the 1918 flu pandemic and what lessons we've learned since then and from then that are assisting us in how we think about the current pandemic that we're in. Everything from what is important about quarantining to how people actually coped to issues of the economy. And if you have a thought or a question you'd like to share, maybe some stories have been handed down to you over the years, or you want to know more from Mark about what he's learned about the history here in Vermont, you can give us a call. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or email vermontedition@vpr.org. And we got a note, Mark, from VPR's marketing and engagement coordinator, Anna St. Marie, who wrote in to say, when the coronavirus crisis ramped up a few weeks ago, I called my 89-year-old mamère to check in with her and see how social distancing was going. She explained that even though many people in her small, isolated Northeast Kingdom community didn't believe they were at much risk, she felt that the risk was very real because she remembered one of our relatives who died during the 1918 flu pandemic in the very house that she has lived in now for 50 plus years. If that seemingly foreign disease could affect someone in her own house, then surely this one could too. It was a good reminder for her and for me that, yes, this does happen here, and yes, it happens to people just like us. Mark, do you see other people reflecting now? I mean, it's over a century ago, so it's hard in some ways to feel connected, but maybe not for some families like Anna's.
Yeah, I think those are the ones who are carrying the legacy of the 1918 pandemic. It doesn't get taught a lot in schools. I think that there's so much focus on World War One that it sort of gets overlooked. And some people say that it's, you know, oh, it's the forgotten pandemic. Well, it's not in some people's families. You know, when I wrote about it, people for VT Digger, some of the comments were people remembering family members who had passed away 100 years ago in the last huge pandemic we've suffered.
In 1918, you know, you wrote about the fact that even though Vermont knew it was coming and that the health commissioner knew that it was coming to Vermont, he didn't realize how quickly it had actually arrived, that it was already spreading. And, you know, the inability to get word out quickly was different than perhaps it is today. So how did Vermonters learn about what they should be doing?
They got it through their local health officers. I mean, the State Board of Health sent out, I think, almost like daily notices to state health advisors, officials, and there were notices in papers and things like that. I mean, there wasn't the same public health efforts that there are now. I mean, you know, how many times have you been told to wash your hands and not touch your face? There wasn't that as much in those days. It was much more of an emphasis on separating people. There were some communities. I mean, like there was an ordinance in San Francisco telling people that they needed to wear masks. So there was some understanding of that. And there are these frightening signs that streetcars in Philadelphia had that said, spit spreads death, you know, to just remind people about basic hygiene issues.
You mentioned, Mark, that the response was state by state and sometimes even more granular, sort of county by county or community by community. There are debates right now today about what role the federal government plays, what rights the president has to close or open certain parts of the economy, and what rights governors have to do that and mayors. And do you see that reflected in what happened in 1918 as well?
Yeah, it was a very local decision. And the state really had a lot of faith in the local officials. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I don't know if that was the right decision to make. It was about, I should say, about 10 days into the pandemic, the State Board of Health finally ordered the closing of all, places of public gathering. And that might seem late, but actually that put Vermont pretty far ahead of the curve compared to other states. And they left that in place for about a month, almost exactly a month. But when they removed it, they were making it clear to local officials that it was up to them to decide whether that ban should stay in place longer. Because they were the people on the ground. They knew what was happening. And they would have a sense of whether to remove removing those bans if that was safe.
When we think about how many people were affected by this flu pandemic in 1918, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, something like 50,000 Vermonters were infected and more than 2,000, it's estimated, died. Put that in context. Now we have about 620,000 residents. How many did we have in 1918? I mean, this was a large percentage of the population that got sick.
Right. Our population was almost, it was about half of what it is now. So it was, I think, one in every 170 Vermonters died. So pretty much everyone would have known someone who died during the pandemic. I mean, to put that in context, if you do the math, I think it comes up to, it would be the equivalent of Vermont losing something like 3,700 people today to get to those kind of, that kind of ratio.
Wow. And something like 20% of the population infected.
Yeah, something like that. And it came in two waves. In the fall, about 1,700 Vermonters died. They lifted the ban on public gatherings, and so it was sort of in early to mid-November, which is when the war, the armistice was signed for the war. Vermont sort of opened up again, but then there was a third wave, and about another 400 people died in the winter and the following spring. So it wasn't really gone.
Let's hear another voice of someone who witnessed the 1918 pandemic firsthand. Here's Helen Austin of Moortown, recorded in 1992, remembering the toll the flu took on her family.
But I lost my mother when I was six with the flu, the 1918 flu.
Oh, the influenza?
The flu and the pneumonia. My father was sick with it, and all of us children, there were five of us, and we were all down with the flu. My mother was a trained nurse. She worked over in the Woodsville, New Hampshire. She graduated from Boston Hospital. But I had just started the first grade. I'd been to school just a month when my mother died. And I started school in September the 1st. Of course, there was no kindergarten back in those days. And I had been to school. She died the 9th of October. And left my brother Keith was the oldest. He was born in 1910 and I was born in 1912. And the others were all younger. Chan was a year younger than I, and Tot, we called him, he was Clayton Jr., was a year younger than Chan. And then my baby sister was only a year old when my mother died. She was born in 17.
Helen Austin of Moortown there, interviewed in 1992 by Jane Beck for the Vermont Folklife Center's Mad River Valley Project, and really bringing home the toll this took on families and how Vermonters were devastated by the 1918 flu pandemic. We're talking with author and historian Mark Bushnell, and we're joined as well now by Amanda Gustin, Public Programs Manager at the Vermont Historical Society. Hi, Amanda. Nice to talk with you.
Hello.
You know, it's interesting to hear people talking about what they remembered, you know, from the flu pandemic. And so few people alive today, many not even here who had connections to those who had connections in 1918. But what are you thinking as you are living through this global pandemic today and thinking back to, you know, a century ago?
You know, it's not common when you work as an historian to have a true, clear, crystal realization that you're living through an historical moment now. That's definitely a different kind of experience. So thinking about all of the things that we learn and think about and study through history and you get a very visceral sense for the kind of emotions people must have been experiencing and the things that were going through their heads in a way I don't know that you can, even just from reading and thinking about history, much less experiencing it.
Yeah, it really brings it home when you hear people's voices. And speaking of people who have connections, let's go to Tony, who's calling in from Barrie. Hi, Tony. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Oh. Hi, how are you?
Well, how are you?
Well, living the dream, right? The first week of this pandemic, I went for a walk in Hope Cemetery. My family came from Spain. They were stone cutters here in Barrie. And I went to the old section of Hope Cemetery, and I was counting the stones that said 1918. And I came across a stone that said Baby Dewey. And I was thinking of all those poor people. And I'm so glad we're on it. We're staying safe. We're wearing our masks and gloves. But I'm just thinking of the fear of the unknown. And I just wanted to share how, like you said earlier, Barrie was hit hard, like New York. So it really touched me.
Well, Tony, thank you for sharing that and for sharing what it felt like to be seeing those graves in Barrie and graves of children who died in 1918. Amanda, you also live in Barrie, is that right?
I do. I'm sheltering in place in my house, and actually I'm about a quarter mile away from Hope Cemetery, so I know exactly the part of the cemetery that Tony's referring to.
Yeah, and Mark was talking earlier about how Barrie was hit very hard, and that's presumably at least in part because many of the stonecutters and many people who were working in the granite industry might have had compromised lungs, which, you know, as you know, for a flu pandemic is puts you in a vulnerable category. You know, have you thought about the Barrie workers as well?
Sure, absolutely. I was reading an interesting statistic that something like almost 4% of the entire population of Barrie died during the pandemic, and that a lot of people, even at the time, when you read sort of accounts of the flu in Barrie, a lot of people were already realized that it was because of those compromised lungs. Granite workers were already suffering from silicosis and indeed already dying from lung-related illnesses that weren't the flu. So it was an extremely vulnerable population. So something like, you know, Mark was estimating the statewide at 1 in 170. And I saw some estimates that for the city of Barrie, it was more like 1 in 30.
Wow. Wow. Let's go to Gail, who's calling in from Elizabethtown, New York. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for letting me on the air. My Aunt Margaret was living in New York during the 1918. And she had flu. She was maybe 16, 17. And only her stepmother could go up and tend to her. And she said that she lived through the flu on a diet of champagne and egg whites. I think that's because they thought egg white didn't stay in the stomach very long.
Gail, what an interesting story, and nice to have that connection. And glad that you had your aunt able to tell us about it and lived through it. Thank you for that. Nancy is with us from Peacham. Nancy, what are you thinking about?
Hello. I found a publication by someone who was born in Peacham, who became an editor and a diplomat. And he wrote North American Review's War Weekly. I looked from beginning, and it wasn't until October 5th that he makes any mention, and he characterizes the plague as a new and deadly enemy. I won't read everything he has to say about it, but then on October 10th, he says, "It is outrageous that the influenza plague was permitted to gain such headway. At its very first appearance, strenuous measures should have been employed for its suppression. The country would have backed the administration in anything needed for that purpose." And he concludes, "Let us hope that no hot gospeler in the administration ranks will attempt to prove that it was a part of an ineffably wise policy conceived by the president to let the plague rage for a time."
Wow, Nancy, what an interesting document to have found.
Yes.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. So interesting, and so interesting to hear from people who have these documents while we have these historians and historical societies on. And Mark, we were talking earlier about the difference between the federal government and state governments and who had control. And here's Nancy's Peachum-born diplomat railing against the president, who he saw as not doing the right thing in this pandemic.
Yeah, and I think that was a case of Wilson worrying about interfering with the war effort, you know, with the Liberty Bond drives and things that I was discussing earlier.
Yeah.
Countries that were at war were, you know, very reluctant to do anything that took the spotlight off of the war and the effort off the war.
Amanda, you know, Nancy found that document and has it and is reading from it. Do you have with the Historical Society a lot of documents from the 1918 pandemic like that?
We have, yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of different sources that touch on the epidemic, whether they are, you know, I'm looking here as I was sitting and listening to Mark. I've got a poster in front of me from Brandon. That was distributed under the advice of the local Board of Health, telling people that the flu would be here soon. And it gives some suggestions for ways to keep healthy that include some things that we would recognize today, like avoid needless crowding and smother your cough and sneezes. But then it also continues to recommend that people avoid tight clothes, tight shoes, and tight gloves. And also to take a glass or two of water when they first wake up in the morning. And then they go right on to say, wash your hands. So a little bit of a mixed advice here, but they were absolutely getting the word out through posters and things like that. And we have some of those. We have journals and diaries, letters, photographs, and we have objects related to the flu as well.
Wow. Yeah, the avoid tight clothes and drink some water sounds like general good fashion and health advice, you know, that maybe they were trying to slip in there alongside the advice to wash your hands.
They also recommend that you chew your food thoroughly. I'm honestly not sure how that would help, but it's definitely one of these 12 points of avoiding respiratory diseases.
You know, they were parents, maybe. That's what you say to your children when they're just learning to chew. Let's go to Alice calling in from Colchester. Hi, Alice.
Hello. Hi, Jane.
Hi, go right ahead.
Footnote is that my great-grandfather died of the flu, and my mother told me he was in the prime of his life, it was before my father was born, so he never knew him. But I specifically wanted to call about a book by Ellen Bryant Voigt called Kyrie, and it's a book of sonnets about the flu pandemic. And so I had sort of known about, you know, this in a very general way, but when I read this book, boy, does it hit in a very emotional way, and about just how terrible it was to die of that. It's like drowning in your own fluids. It's a hard-hitting book. You would think a book of sonnets would sound like it's, you know, sort of sweet, but it's pretty powerful stuff.
Well, Alice, thank you for sharing your story and for that interesting recommendation. You join Andrea in Burlington, who wrote in to also recommend that people might want to check out Kyrie, Ellen Bryant Voigt's book of poetry, where she writes from the perspective of those living in the 1918 pandemic. So thank you for sharing that. And Joyce is with us from Hubbardton. Hi, Joyce. You have a family story to share, too?
Yeah, this is more of a happy ending. My grandmother in 1918 was pregnant with my mother's oldest sister, my aunt, and my grandmother was very sick with the flu, and the family story that we've been passing around, family stories on the internet since this happened, and was that she was so sick they don't think she even knew she had a baby. And the doctor said, I probably can save her life, but don't even bother dressing the baby. We've never had a flu baby live yet. And my aunt lived well into her 60s until she died of cancer. So that's our family's flu story. And then my grandmother's youngest sister, who was still a child living at home with her family, another sister had the flu, and she remembers having to go stay with a neighbor until her sister got over the flu. But all of them lived. So.
Oh, wow, that's lucky. And Joyce, it's interesting. You said your family has been swapping these stories since the coronavirus pandemic started?
Yeah, some of the email stories. I had heard it before, but I'd forgotten the story because I'm 76. So, you know, these stories have been around a while. but somebody else mentioned and was saying, I think there was somebody in the family, and somebody wrote, yeah, that was my mother. It was my mother that was the baby at that time. So,
yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you shared that with us. Thank you. And what a story that your aunt survived, that she was a flu baby who made it, you know, after being written off by the doctors. And I do think it's interesting, Joyce, that so many people, I think, are thinking back to family stories and family history, whether it's 1918 related or not. I think sometimes when people are under such stress and worry, you do think about your relatives in the past and those who lived through really challenging times. And if they're not alive anymore, at least for me, I wish I could speak to them about what it was like to go through that and speak to, for example, to my grandmother who lived through that flu pandemic and the depression. And I wish I could have her perspective now. So it's nice to have that, Joyce.
It is. And my grandmother was one of nine children, and their ages were like 20 years apart. So the youngest one, and my mother's cousin, is younger than I am. So we've got those generations mixed together to remember and hear some of those stories and to share. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Joyce. I appreciate that. Mary Ann over in Jay, New York writes, my husband's maternal grandmother, who was born in 1911, credits her family's survival of the 1918 flu pandemic with the fact that they slept on a sleeping porch over a bushel of onions. She repeated that story many times in the years that I knew her, and she lived to be nearly 100 years old. I love that story, Mary Ann. Thank you very much. Mark Bushnell, while we have you here, you know, we talked a little bit about this, but maybe you can help sort of put a cap on it of how Vermont got through the pandemic, how not only did it start to open back up again and recover, but recover economically and emotionally as so many people had been affected.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a hard time. It was different than now because they didn't have that whole idea of flattening the curve, and there frankly wasn't a lot doctors could do at the time. So it was this hot burning fire that, I mean, in the course of a few weeks, you know, 1,700 Vermonters died, and then another 400 died in the coming months. And I think we're in a really different situation than that. But I think I actually find it somewhat reassuring to read details about the epidemic in 1918, because it was in many ways much worse than what we're dealing with now. And somehow society kept it together. You know, it gives me hope that, you know, this may take longer to get through than what they dealt with in 1918, but we'll get through it.
I hope you're right about that, Mark, and I'm assured that you are. You know, we will get through it one way or another, but I hope we can learn some of those lessons about how to get through it well.
Yeah, I mean, it's communities stuck together and took care of each other. I mean, there's stories about I interviewed people back on the 80th anniversary of this, and a fellow I talked to from Montgomery Center talked about how the deaconess at the church, you know, everyone needs to figure out something to do. And she made this huge pot of chicken soup and carried it around in a barrel, you know, in a wheelbarrow, and took it house to house and fed the sick. There's so many stories of neighbors taking care of neighbors and family members helping each other. You know, it gives you hope that people will rally. I mean, Vermont has done that to a great extent already.
Yeah, absolutely. That's author and historian Mark Bushnell, and we'll link to his piece in VT Digger about the 1918 pandemic and how it hit Vermont. Mark, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome, Jane.
We're joined as well now by Andy Kolovis, Associate Director and Archivist with the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury. Hi, Andy. Nice to talk with you again.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking about the 1918 flu pandemic and hearing people's pretty amazing stories, but also talking with Amanda about some of the artifacts the Historical Society has. What about the Vermont Folklife Center? Do you have artifacts or oral histories which you specialize in from 1918?
Yeah, we have some things where people reflect on it, but, you know, one of the things that COVID-19 inspired us to do was to go back into the archive and try to see what we could find. And I was kind of surprised at how scant the content was.
Why do you think that is? Do you think you just don't have it, or maybe people didn't want to share that kind of thing?
You know, I mean, I'm just speculating, and I think there are a couple factors. I think it's quite possible that one of the major ones was that it was just something that people really didn't want to talk about unless they were directly engaged on it. Also, I suspect the timing, the bulk of the interviews we've done that focus on the earlier 20th century were done in the 80s and 90s. And most of the people who were around then had been kids around the time the pandemic occurred.
Mm.
So those are my two main guesses.
Amanda, what do you think from the Historical Society? You said you do have quite a few artifacts, but do you see that same kind of sentiment that Andy was talking about at all?
I don't know that we see exactly the same sentiment because we're dealing with very different sources. So the Folklife Center focuses more on oral history and sort of personal conversations, recorded conversations with people. And the Vermont Historical Society was around in 1918 and has been since 1838. So it was already actively collecting things like the broadside I mentioned earlier, and shortly after the flu, already collecting letters and diaries and things like that. And people were sort of quite candid and emotionally open in their letters and diaries, and mentioned it. It's I think you go through just about any source from that time period and you find at least some mention of it, and as well as artifacts and things like that. Everything really did revolve around that for about a 2-month period. So we have a lot of recollections of it. We only have a handful of oral histories. Some of the ones we've been playing during this episode come from a collecting project that we did in the 1980s as well. And it does have some of that same challenges that most of the people who were around by the time recording technology got enough were children during the pandemic. So our good sources are all written down.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear about. Let's go to a few more calls here and then we'll shift to talking about, you know, what your organizations are doing and thinking about how people can preserve their history today for future generations. Ed is calling in from Addison. Hi, Ed. What's your story?
Hi, Jane. My wife's grandmother was a young married woman with three little kids across the border in Quebec. Got the flu in 1918 and died. And so her grandfather was stuck with three little kids to take care of. And the local priest suggested, and this was not uncommon at the time, that he marry his deceased wife's sister, which is what he did.
Hmm. And did that story get handed down through the family in what kind of way? You know, how was that talked about?
Well, there were the three original kids all survived, and two lived to be 101. And the other three, two are still living, and one is 95. So that story has gotten passed down because, the grandmother that my wife grew up with was not the birth grandmother, so to speak.
Yeah, how interesting. And I guess, you know, the father and then the sister who he married had a shared grief, too, about the other one who died. Thank you for sharing that, Ed. Let's go to Meg, who's calling in from Barnet. Hi, Meg. You have a story,
Hi.
Too.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So my grandmother emigrated to the United States and from Sweden in 1918 and didn't speak a word of English, but she got hired as a nanny to help with the children of a doctor who was leaving New York City to get his family to his summer home to escape the influenza. So she learned to speak English by reading storybooks to little children who had memorized their storybooks.
Hmm. Meg, thanks for sharing that. I love hearing how many people have these stories from their families that have been carried on, and it makes you wonder what stories are going to be carried on to people from 100 years, 100 years from now. One more thought in here from Gil, who's been on the line with us from Moultonboro, New Hampshire. Hi, Gil.
Hello.
Hi, what are you sharing?
I was reading a book this morning. I just got it yesterday. It's called Menegluk. It's about an Inuit teacher who photographed Alaska from 1907 to 1932. And in all, there's about 100 photographs in there. And out of the 100 photographs, I'll bet half of the people died in the 1918 influenza.
Wow, it's interesting to think about that.
It was right around Nome, Alaska, in that area, and out on the islands.
Yeah, Gil, what an interesting thing to think about in terms of, looking at photos of vibrant families and then thinking about a whole family that may have been wiped out by the flu. Thanks for sharing that. Amanda and Andy, I'd love to talk with you about, you know, we're hearing these stories. And as I said, it's interesting to think about how we preserve what's important from what we're experiencing now and make sure that generations ahead of us understand what we think was important. They're going to decide for themselves as well other things that they think are important. And we don't know, you know, what the outcome from this is all going to be yet. So we don't know necessarily what's important. But Andy, how are you thinking about, with the Folklife Center, what people can do to preserve their own stories and what the an organization like the Folklife Center would want to make sure it had?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the real thing that inspired this project on our part, the Listening in Place project, was this desire to find a way for people to maintain connections with each other while we're all isolated. You know, so the first thing that we really were focused on was how can we help foster and maintain these connections? And we thought about the methods we use, which is interviewing, and we thought, okay, maybe that's a way to do it. You know, so the focus of our efforts is really on that kind of interpersonal engagement. And the preservation, which is important, is a facet of it, but really not the focus, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, because we're trying to find a way to get for help people get through this, you know, which is pretty key. You know, the things that I thought about, because my experience is like other people's, but also different, is about being at home a lot, you know, and being at home a lot with, in my case, my family, because I'm fortunate to have people around me. And it's, what are the things that people are talking about? You know, what are the experiences like that you're having now? What does it sound like in your house, in your neighborhood, when you go out? You know, what are you encountering out in the world? So those are sort of the primary things we're focused on. But it's also this idea of how do we make these connections? And that even like, you know, even thinking about face masks and people making face masks as material objects. And how are those about making connections between people, both the act of creating them and the act of sharing pictures of them and of yourself wearing them? You know, so that issue, that's kind of the scope we're most interested in, I'd say.
Yeah. And you have a Show Us Your Masks photo project.
Yeah. 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 And that's the thing. It's like, how can a physical object, you know, material culture being the term we'd use, help communicate what people are experiencing now and what their lives are like? You know, and these masks are a ubiquitous part of that to me. So documenting those things and the experience of it, but also acknowledging the roles they're serving, the complicated and broad roles they're serving for people right now, too.
Amanda Gustin, I understand in the Historical Society, some of the artifacts you have from 1918, and I don't know whether they're the actual sputum flasks themselves that people were advised to spit into or cough into instead of, you know, just out into the air, or if you just have pictures and documents of them. But, you know, maybe you can describe them and what you think the sputum flasks of today are, the archival materials that we're going to be collecting like masks.
Sure. We do have the actual sputum flasks. It's basically a flat piece of sort of waxed paper that you would fold according to lines that are on the paper, rolled up into a little box, and then you could dispose of it. The company's name is Burn It All, giving you a sort of hint as to the best way to dispose of what is now medical waste. So there was a sense that people should be, you know, taking care of themselves with hygienic practices. And, you know, they were originally intended for tuberculosis patients, but did have crossover into the flu as well. As for what will be the equivalent to that for the 21st century for this pandemic, you know, like the Folklife Center, we've also launched our own collecting initiative. And, you know, I've been thinking about it a lot in some of the ways that Andy was saying about how we connect people to a larger story. All of these stories that the callers are sharing of their own family experiences, you know, make us think a lot about how there is a big shared experience that a lot of people are having right now, but there is also such a highly personal nature and a highly individual story. So we want to explore how all these individual stories can make up a larger narrative. So we're inviting people to share photographs of their communities, documenting things that are different, things that are catching their eye right now, empty store shelves or people standing 6 feet apart from each other on the sidewalk or wearing masks or signs and things like that. So we're asking people to take photographs and upload them or to write out, you know, what's your daily life been like? What's a particularly sort of quirky or interesting thing that's happened to you or a story like that so that people can realize, you know, you're not alone in this, but you are also having a unique experience.
As for what we're actually going to be collecting, we're not sure yet either. We'll have to see. I would imagine the face masks are up there, and then maybe some of the inventions that people are coming up with to help fight things.
So, you know, when people do that and are taking pictures, I mean, one of the differences that I think about from a century ago to now is there are so many pictures and so many text messages and so many, you know, notes that people are writing in various places. But that ubiquity might also mean that it's hard to sort of sort through what's important or you know, what the trends are because of just the volume, and that people don't think about preservation in the same way. You know, what you're putting on Instagram or TikTok, you're not necessarily thinking some historian 100 years from now is going to find valuable. So there may not even be any preservation thought at all in that kind of thing. And Andy, how do you think, you know, as people move through this, they should think about how their activities and how their documentation could be preserved?
Boy, well, you know, with media stuff, you know, with creating videos and photos and audio recordings, it's really valuable to back them up if you're storing them at home. And that's crucial. Also, giving them file names that are meaningful to you so that you'll in the future will know what it is, you know. But digital stuff is really tough. It's not like the same thing as finding a letter in an attic necessarily. You know, 50 years from now, the stuff we create, unless it's curated, might very well be totally inaccessible. So this is why repositories like the Folklife Center and the Historical Society and others in the state that deal with digital materials are really valuable partners in keeping this stuff around.
Well, we'll put links up to both these organizations and information about how you can share documents that might be important in the future and are important now, as well as how you can do things like the Listening in Place project that Andy was talking about to stay connected, whether it's for posterity or not, this ability to talk with others and stay connected. And Amanda and Andy, thank you both very much for sharing your perspective and your organizations with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
That's Amanda Gustin, Public Programs Manager at the Vermont Historical Society, and Andy Kolovis, Associate Director and Archivist with the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury.